increasing productivity through inclusion. So much is said about diversity, and most organizations have put a tick behind diversity. They meet the numbers, particularly in the Western countries. However, we all know to know what to do is only part of the story. Much more difficult is to understand how to do it, and that is about the inclusion. So even if the numbers are right, we see more and more a shift that organizations focus on inclusion and wonder how best to do it. So I'm really excited to speak with Belton Flournoy, who is Managing Director of Protivity and involved in many inclusion initiatives. He believes it is much more than a moral issue. Rather, it has real productivity gains for organizations. I'm Dr. Sabine Demkowski, founder and managing partner of Better Boards. We make the boards of the most ambitious organizations more effective. Our mission at Better Boards is to contribute to creating better boards. We do this by providing clients with an evidence-based approach for board evaluations and board development programs. Leading organizations use our innovative board evaluation platform for their internal board evaluations to develop their boards systematically. And professional services organizations use our platform as part of their overall service offering. To fulfill our mission, we give a voice to all who care about creating better boards. Belton, thank you so much for contributing to the Better Boards podcast series.
Thank you for having me here today. Very excited.
Belton, I mean, we were recently together on a panel and I was so impressed with what you have done and also how you answered the questions for the audience. So I, of course, just had to invite you. You are so passionate about inclusion, and besides your demanding day-to-day job, you devote a lot of your time outside of that job to support initiatives. And I mean, there are almost too many to mention. TLC Lions, the technology community of For Racial Equality, and most recently, the London School of Economics Inclusion Initiative. Why does it matter to you?
I think there's two reasons. One, when I was young, I looked up and didn't see many people like me. And I think when you don't see people like you, you almost fear that society won't allow you in certain circles. And secondly, I had a trigger moment when I had just delivered a program at a global investment bank. It's a regulatory remediation program. And I was invited to meet their global head of change. And right before I walked in the door, my colleague at the time I worked for 2 years, looked at me and said, "By the way, don't let him know you're gay." And I said, "Of course not. This is work. It has nothing to do with work." But we went into that meeting and we talked about his personal life, my personal life. And when I left that meeting and talked to a friend, my friend was just asking the question, "What would you do if you joined a conference call and someone said, don't let them know you're black?" Well, I responded with, "I would join that conference call and say, hello, this is Black Belton, because I'm proud of my race and no one can tell me not to talk about my race." Yet when it came to my orientation, I realized I was more than happy to hide it. And from that moment, I started working with the mayor of London and Pride in London to create an initiative to help amplify LGBT voices all across London. And that's really one of the trigger points for me wanting to start to drive change, to make sure nobody out there who doesn't feel that they can be all that they can be, help to inspire those people to help them realize their true potential.
There might be some listeners who say, does it matter to me? What do you say to people who may not believe in the diversity journey, who say, well, I have nothing to do with black people, I have nothing to do with LGBT plus, why should I care? What do you say to such people?
Well, I think the first thing is, it's not just those people. I think there's a whole group of people who say yes. They're like, oh, yes, I care, but they don't really. People who care are the people who use their power and their minds to identify the problems and drive the change. So you can have a CEO in an organization who just delegates driving inclusion to HR, and they spend their efforts focusing on the financial results. But what we need to do in order to convince those individuals is bring in data. We shouldn't just focus on trying to increase inclusion and here are the initiatives we're doing. we should try to create a narrative. So with the Technology Community for Racial Equality, the goal of that organization is to increase racial representation in the tech sector to address the skills gap in the UK to help increase GDP. Now, we know a skills gap exists. We know that by addressing and closing that skills gap has an impact on GDP. And we know that helping individuals to transition into high-income jobs is a good thing. And so all of a sudden, the narrative is, how do we increase the UK's GDP? And I think it's the same with diversity in organizations. We don't just need to focus on the diversity initiatives and how it makes people feel, but we need to link up to increased productivity, the increased outcomes that feelings of inclusion has up for their employees.
And what do you think has shifted when you put it down to hard economic measures, actually?
So I think what's shifted, so for example, the Black Lives Matter movement was one of the first times in recent times where executives around the world did not know what to do. They spend tons of money on business continuity plans, programs to resume operations in the event of a disaster. They do what-if scenarios, but then that happened and everyone said, do we put out statements? Do we not? Is it appropriate? Is it not? Is it political? Is it not? And that's a true example of not understanding the organization's values and cultures in order to make a response. Now, I think since that, some of the ramifications, it's driven a lot more dollars in the long term towards supporting these initiatives. And I think organizations like Women in Banking and Finance, the Inclusion Initiative, TLC Lions, I think they're working to do is they're working to educate people on the strategic benefits to an organization to start having more dollars flow through to more research programs, to more initiatives, to really help drive more feelings of inclusion across more employees because we're starting to see the productivity benefits.
What do you say to organizations? I mean, a lot of organizations have initiatives to really drive inclusion, but they sign up for diversity because they think, yes, it's the right thing to do. But a lot of them struggle actually with genuine inclusion. What do you say to organizations who really look to drive inclusion at board level and also at any other level in the organization?
This is a good one. So I'll say two things about this. I think the first is there was a study by McKinsey, and it articulated that 80% of senior executives are out at work. But then it articulated that just 32% of junior employees are out at work. Now, when I speak to senior individuals in organizations, they know their diversity policy. They have their inclusion statements on the internet. They're deploying unconscious bias across the organization. The CEO is signing off on funding for these roles because they believe in it. But what we have to also realize is there's the middle management layer that interprets and is the guts of any organization. And if you haven't driven the true inclusion values through that layer, it won't permeate all the way through your organization. And you might find that you think your organization is a lot more inclusion oriented than it really is because you're surrounded by the people at the top and you may not be driving for as big of change. I think the second thing is data and metrics. What I find disheartening at times is when you look at annual reports and they talk about all the great diversity initiatives that they have in place. But every year, these initiatives are quite subjective, and they're not as objective as it would be if you were implementing a new technology, if you were looking to target new customer segments, if you were looking to do something strategic. And when these organizations do something strategic, they set targets, they set success criteria, they set a budget, and they report on it monthly with red, amber, green. And when they do diversity initiatives, they tend to just report on it in a very subjective way. And so what I would say is, organizations really looking to drive change, treat it like a program. Set targets, define what success looks like, and avoid falling to certain biases. Two biases that are common, I would say, in the diversity and inclusion world would be the planning fallacy. That's where you feel that you can do more than you actually will achieve. And we all fall victim to that. But the second is the intent versus action gap. I think when you don't have clear metrics and success criteria defined, you can have the strongest intentions. You can have everyone talking about it in the organization. You can be putting a lot of thought leadership about it and telling everyone what you plan on doing. But but you haven't defined actions in a clear enough way to allow you to achieve your success. So making sure you clearly document what you want to do, but also the outcomes, is one of the things that's really going to help drive meaningful change.
And talking about data, I mean, you are involved with the London School of Economics, the Inclusion Initiative, as we mentioned, and there was some superb research coming out. Can you share maybe some of the insights from that research with our listeners?
Yes. So the London School of Economics has created a inclusion initiative, and it's supported by Richard Nesbitt, who's the ex-CEO of the Canadian Stock Exchange, and Dr. Grace Lorden, who's one of the most amazing academics that anyone can meet. And their goal is to create research that helps organizations to drive inclusion through evidence-based research. And so it's not research like many organizations do, where they go and conduct surveys and then they just report back their interpretation of the surveys. What the London School of Economics really looks to do is it looks to follow executives through their day, ask them questions, understand what changes those organizations have implemented, and then measure the impact that those changes have had to make real recommendations to say, this is what worked and this didn't. And so it helps organizations drive real change. Two really interesting pieces of research that I'll mention is one is virtual inclusion in the city, which was done right when COVID happened, and it was trying to understand the impact of remote working on the workforce. What was really interesting about that study was it talked about how the inclusion rolled back for many women and ethnic minorities. And part of that was due to the fact that the in-group became more prevalent. And so when you needed something done, you'd pick up the phone and call someone you knew, call someone you're comfortable with, rather than being in the office where you might look around or go to someone. And the other piece of thought leadership that is quite interesting was one that articulated mediocre managers are the ones holding women back in the workplace. And it articulates the fact that there's a lot of managers who are so focused on the delivery side, but less so on the people side, that they don't always translate the corporate values into how they manage their teams. And as a result, it has a disproportionate impact on females in the workplace. And what that means is it needs a dedicated focus to educate middle management on the company's values. And one last piece that I'll mention, because this other one is also quite interesting, and it's where Grace did some research, and the outcome of that research articulated that men in the workplace typically get to progress because of their ability. However, women sometimes have to rely on luck. And the reason for that is because if you have a male and a female operating equally, that man is more likely to have opportunities presented to themselves due to various biases that exist in the workplace. And if we really want to try to tackle those issues, the first thing we need to do is make sure people are aware of what are these biases. And it's not just the unconscious bias, but there's a lot of additional biases that are impacting leaders on a day-to-day basis.
That's really, really helpful data points. And bringing it more to the real life, maybe you can share a little bit what has really helped you personally to develop your career. What have you done? What do you think was it about your behaviors, your actions that helped you to progress?
Yeah, I think two that have helped me is one is the fixed versus growth mindset. And I do talk about this quite a bit in my talks. And a fixed mindset is where you feel you're set in your ways. You know what you're good at. You know what you're not good at. And a growth mindset is where you truly believe you can continuously learn and grow. Now, what's interesting is as people get older, they tend to move more into the fixed mindset. Yet when you talk to intelligent and successful people, they will say they're in the growth mindset. And the example I always ask people is, I say, you could become a TikTok superstar. But you might laugh and say, no, I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't know how to use that. Well, that's not true. We're actually all smart enough to know how to use something, but we choose not to. And I think it's very important for us to make sure we don't tell ourselves we're not good at X, because that's not true. There's nothing you're not good at. You just haven't invested enough time in training, reading, planning on that particular topic, activity, or sport in order to become good at it. But you're capable of it. So I don't tell myself I'm not good at anything. I tell myself, what do I need to learn in order to get better at? And that mindset is truly, truly transformational. Another is the locus of control, which Grace Lorden talks about in her book, Think Big. And what the locus of the control articulates is the extent that you are in control of your own life. And so let's say someone who is let go from their job, they might go to their friends and say, I'm let go because of my boss, because of the economy, because of this, because of that. But what they're doing is they're saying that that departure is only due to external factors. And that does nothing but make them feel better. If you flip that on its head and you say, what can I do to make this an internal locus of control? Those things still might be true, but you would then say, what can I do to make sure this never happens to me again? What trainings can I do? What additional certifications can I do? What additional networking should I do? And all of a sudden it becomes action-oriented for you to enhance who you are. And so if you're ever sitting in a situation and you find yourself blaming external factors, you need to pause and say, actually, that's not helping anybody or even me get better. What can I do to prevent this from happening to me again? Because we are the only things that we can control in our own lives.
No, that's very, very good advice. And I'm seeing a lot of people who have finally managed to get hold of this board position. Yeah, so they finally made it. They are now appointed. And they come from an ethnically diverse background. What should they do in the first weeks? I think it very much relates to what you just described.
Yes, it is. So the first is realize you deserve to be there. I think so many people enter senior positions and their mindset is, okay, I'm here to now learn so I can then do a good job. But in a board position, you don't have that much time. And so what you need to make sure you do is from day one, realize your voice is valid. From day one, realize your voice is important because they brought you in for a reason. And on day one, if you see things that aren't working or if you see things that you think could be improved upon, it's your duty to speak up because you are that different person who's now coming into a group of people who have slowly conformed to a way of operating. And those difference of opinion is what can help you really succeed. The other element that I think is quite important is understanding that leadership and engagement and even difficult conversations, navigating those are all skills. And I used to believe that those are skills that some people were good at and some people were bad at. And then I did my MBA and I realized that those skills can be learned just like a language. And the more you invest in learning how to navigate difficult conversations, how you can navigate having effective communication and persuasion techniques, the more effective you can be in those board roles. And so don't just focus on the content knowledge that brought you in that room. Realize there's a whole nother avenue of learning that you can do in order to be more successful.
And shifting now from the individual to the organizations. I mean, a lot of organizations realize, and we all know, diversity is a measure. Inclusion is a skill. What have you seen organizations do to really help people with diverse background to really integrate, to really be the best they can be in the environment of an organization?
I think an important thing is to understand what does true inclusion mean. I think we sometimes focus on, we want different people in the room. We talk about being your authentic self. We put out this unconscious bias training, but we really don't think about, is everyone included? So are you the type of leader to make sure everyone in your meeting speak? Or do you typically let the loudest voices in the room dominate the conversation? There was this TLC Lions Awards that I went to, and there was this young man who won an award. And when he was on stage accepting his award, one of the things he said was, I never thought I'd be somewhere like this. And I hope everyone in this room realizes that my ceiling was your floor. And I've already shattered everything I thought I was capable of. And that comment just shook me because when you are in an organization and you have people working for you that may not believe in themselves, part of our role is to find that untapped potential to release it in our organizations. It's to create that energy and that drive to get people to really want to work for our brand and our values and our mission. And when you can figure out how to turn your organization's values into passion for your organization's productivity is going to skyrocket. You're going to have a lot less departures.
Makes me very thoughtful, to be honest. I just contrast it in my head to what I'm seeing very often. And it doesn't yet square up in many, many situations. And I also know, you know, sometimes white directors, they are well-meaning, they have good intentions, but they don't really know what to do. They feel a little bit helpless. They don't want to do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. What do you think a white middle-class director should do to embrace that person with a different background? Can you give them some practical tips? I mean, it sounds awkward, and I really hope that, you know, when people might listen to this podcast in 2 or 3 years' time, that they are laughing about this question. But I know it is an issue that a lot of people don't really know what to do and how to do it.
Yeah, I think one example I'll give before I answer the question is I like to support groups that I'm not a part of, and I like to be an ally. And so I go to lots of women's events. And I remember going to this one women's event, and there was a female speaking at the front of the room saying, we need to have more diversity in the workplace. We need to have more women leaders. We need to. And I looked around the room, and there was 2 black women in a room of 300-400 people. And I think when you see that, you're like, that room needs to focus on diversity in its own organization alongside pushing for diversity. And I think the first is that self-awareness of being somebody who wants to drive the change rather than someone who's on the journey. Because I think when you have individuals who want to fully embrace colleagues with an ethnic diverse background, but they view it as, I want to accept them, and they leave it there, that's not going to be as effective as, what is our organization doing on diversity? I want to understand, is there any networks that I can actually join as an ally and go to? Because we want people in the room who don't look like us. If you're at a Black History Month event, if you're an LGBT event, they want people who are different. If you're at a women's event, they want male allies. And so the first step is going and supporting those groups in your organization, because that's how you genuinely and authentically show you really want to fully embrace your colleagues of a different background. It's not simply just trying to find ways to make them feel comfortable when they're in the room. It's being proactive about finding ways to support. I think the other thing is, if you don't have time for that, because you are such a senior individual, always, always, always ask people, say, I'm learning. Can I ask you a personal question? People might say no, but if they say yes, they're going to be more open to having a conversation that might help to educate and inspire.
Now, sadly, we have to come to an end of our discussion. And I will always ask this difficult question at the end. What are the 3 things our listeners should take away from this podcast?
So the 3 things is, number one, if you are a senior leader, you understand it's alone at the top. Sometimes you can't talk to people about challenges in the workplace because it's not appropriate. Sometimes you don't get feedback. But one thing someone told me, and it's just an amazing action, is create a personal board. Identify 3 to 6 people that you will talk to between 1 and 4 times a year in a professional context about your career. I think that's just transformed how I'm able to get feedback on some challenging issues you deal with as a senior leader. And it really helps if you have a diverse group of people you're coming from, even people that you may not know and or even feel comfortable with. Having a diverse group of people that you're able to use as a sounding board, it's a great thing. Number 2, don't listen to that voice in your head. You are able to say, I actually don't believe that. If it says you're not good enough, instead of just let it sitting with that, you need to say, no, I am. So realizing that voice in your head is just that, it's a voice. It's not who you are, allows you to challenge it and overcome that negative narrative that we sometimes get. And 3rd, and this is probably more of an action-oriented one and a little plug, but the London School of Economics and Productivity are currently running a study called Generations, and it's a 3-year study. And what we're trying to understand is how generational differences in the workplace impact productivity, because for the first time ever, we have around 5 different generations alive. And many of them across all different age groups are in that generation. And having baby boomers and Gen Z working on the same teams is actually starting to have an impact on productivity. And so we're trying to do one of the largest studies of its kind to understand the implications of that. And we'd love if all of your listeners would get involved, Google the study and click to do it.
Fantastic, Belton. Thank you so, so much for contributing to the Better Bots podcast series.
No worries. And thank you for having me.
How can we help you and your board? We at Better Boards are always delighted to hear from you. We welcome your feedback to the podcast. If you would like to have more information about our services or see a demo of our platform, reach out. You can best reach us at info@better-boards.com. Thank you for listening.